take it away.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, Feminist Waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. We've got a special interview today with Mar from the musical project For Esme. Now, for those who don't know, For Esme is a music project and an unabashedly feminist exploration of self-love and the courage of conviction in uncertain times. The songs of For Esme push the limits of pop and provokes an honest exchange of identity and inner voice. Here is our interview with Mar from For Esme.
Sure. I'm Mar Meredith. I'm the front woman and general creative director of For Esme, which has been my musical project for, I've actually lost track of how many years, I guess we must be pushing seven now, maybe more. And we've put out three records, two of which I put out with like the group of bandmates that I've been working with for a while now. The most recent one was Righteous Woman in 2018. And yeah, in COVID, I'm like making music, but I don't have anything to put out in the immediate future, but I'm definitely working on new stuff and thinking about new stuff. So I'm excited to talk more about that maybe later.
So I want to go way back. Can you tell me about how you got into music in the first place and how For Esme came together?
Sure. I've always loved music ever since I was a tiny human. My parents were always like, they're not super musical, so they were always confused about why I like wanted to sing and dance and perform all the time. But yeah, I've always loved singing. I think I always had an interest in writing music, but I definitely didn't have confidence that I could do it myself until probably university, I think, is when I started writing music. And I was just writing on acoustic guitar and I started having a lot of fun doing that. And I quickly realized I was having so much more fun writing music than I was like doing my undergrad degree. So after university, I moved here to Toronto to like really try to take a chance and focus on this. And so after a couple years, I came up with the For Esme idea. I've always been a really big fan of J.D. Salinger's writing, which is where the name came from. I've since realized that J.D. Salinger is like super problematic in a bunch of ways. I think he had a lot of issues with mistreating young women. So I'm kind of reckoning with that right now. But since my project's so feminist, and I always try to think about how, like, I don't know, if Esme is the little girl from that story that's maybe, now that I'm older looking back, like kind of being preyed upon by an older man, I like to think that at least the music I'm writing about is about giving voice to young women and a voice that I wish I had when I was younger. So I don't know, I'm still kind of struggling with that, but it's something I definitely acknowledge and I'm thinking about, but that's where the name came from. And yeah, we were a trio for a while, then it's kind of been moving parts. I love to change it up, and the bigger my ideas get, the more people are required to make them happen. So right now, well, most recently when we've toured, we've been a five piece. And I'm collaborating with a few people from that five piece on the work I've been working on this year. But it's all kind of a work in progress, and it can always, I like that it can always change who the cast of people that are going to perform are.
So on the official site, it says that For Esme is, quote, an unabashedly feminist exploration of self-love and the courage of conviction in uncertain times. I don't know if you wrote Uncertain Times before COVID.
It was, actually. I kind of forgot about that. Yeah, now it's more uncertain than ever.
But can you tell us a bit more about why, or about this feminist exploration and what it means to you in the project?
Sure. I've identified as feminist for a long time. Like, specifically, I remember since when I was doing my undergrad and learning about, even just realizing how underrepresented women were in academia, and how like all the readings I was doing in my politics classes were all by like old white men, and how reading a reading a woman's perspective was often deemed as like a radical thing, and I was like, it shouldn't be radical, it should be normal. But yeah, I think ever since I've been doing music, like, it's always been important for me to write about I'm really interested in cultural critique and like interrogating the things that I think are wrong with the world. And often I don't like to be too like prescriptive about what I think other people should be doing to make the world better, but it's often more interrogating myself about what I could be doing or how I could be living to be more overtly feminist, I guess. And we're probably going to get into this later, but I'm actually doing my master's right now at U of T in this program called Community Development and Adult Education. So this semester I'm taking a class on feminist theory, and it's been so much fun for me to be back in that world, and it's like feeding my brain so much in terms of it's a lot of amazing thinkers that I always have been interested in, but to have to study them kind of academically is exciting for me. But this semester we're reading a book called Living a Feminist Life by Sarah Emmett, and it's blowing my mind. Like, it's already stuff I've thought about, but she's just giving voice to all these things that I've been writing about and thinking about for a long time, and it's cool to see them in a different form, like a non-musical form, and think about what that means. And I think, I mean, I've talked about this in the record and since, but like, you know, I'm a white straight cis lady, and so my feminism is always expanding, and I'm trying to expand it to be a lot more broad and to include a lot more other perspectives and voices. And I'm increasingly thinking a lot about what capitalism and decolonization mean in terms, like, I don't think feminism is going to be super valuable without those pieces now. And I guess I've always known that, but I'm getting more into that now.
So speaking of this, your music obviously follows these themes. I want to play a song for our listeners called For Others. Can you tell us a bit about this song?
Sure. So I wrote For Others around when I was getting married to my husband, Charlie, who's like one of my oldest, dearest friends, and he's fabulous. But I had a lot of weird things about getting married. I wasn't even sure if like that fit with my feminist agenda or not, but I also wanted it. So it was confusing, and I felt like I was kind of struggling with this, what felt like a diverging choice of like, am I going to pursue music, or am I going to pursue like having a family and a husband and a life that is, and I've since realized that of course it's possible to have both, but I don't think our culture like makes it easy to have both. And I was really struggling with the concept of whether or not I want to have kids, which is funny because now a couple years later, like all my friends are having kids this year, and I'm like, oh, you know what? Kids are cool. Like, kids are actually awesome, and it's not as scary to imagine having a life and having kids. But that's where I was at when I was writing that, and I was really struggling between those two things.
So this is the song For Others by For Esme.
Thank you.
Just heard the song For Others by For Esme. So we've interviewed many musicians over the years to speak about their gendered experience of the music industry, whether that's on tour, writing, performing. I'm curious what your experience is working in music and if you've encountered or observed any similar limitations as a woman in music.
Yes, I sure have. I think it's hard. It's hard to be a woman in music. I think any woman in this field can probably relate to that. I've run into tons of sexist bullshit over the years and people condescendingly telling me what to do and men assuming I don't know how to use my gear or don't know how to do a sound check or just generally being like mansplained to about all kinds of stuff. But I also recognize, like I really recognize that a lot of women have it harder than I do. I've had access to things that lots of women don't. And I'm always conscious when there's like, I think there's such a push in the industry right now to have better representation when it comes to women. But then you'll be like, oh, it's interesting that all these women were invited, but we're all white, or all these women were invited, but we're all cis and straight. And it's like, I don't know. I think I'm increasingly conscious that even though my experience has been hard, I need to use that. My anger about how hard mine has been to advocate for other people who have it even harder. But yeah, it can be the worst for sure. But I also think I will add, I think it was around 2014, 2015, I started like really getting to know a lot of other women in the industry, especially here in Toronto. And it totally changed my life and it totally changed my career because working with women and like collaborating and sharing the experience and having each other to talk to, like it just made everything so much more fun and so much more fulfilling and exciting. So even though it's hard, I think, I don't know, I would not want to be a woman in the music industry. So yeah, and I think it's changing slowly. I mean, it's interesting to still see, I know last week I noted like more abusers in the Canadian industry are being outed, and I know there's more to come. And that sucks. Like, it's hard to see that men are still not held to the same standard by any stretch as the women in this industry are. But I'm hoping it'll change. I'm hoping it's changing.
Yeah. So you mentioned people being held accountable, as well as having more representation in the music industry. Are there any other things or solutions you think that would help women get into music?
Yeah, I mean, I think having mentors is so important. And I think that's important in every field. And it's something I've been thinking about and reading about in the schoolwork I'm doing lately, too. Like, it's hard in academia if you look up and you don't see any women professors in your field, or if you don't see any women of color in your field, if you don't see any trans people in your field, and you're like, well, can I fit into that space? So I know for me, when I meet and can look up to women who are like incredible audio engineers or incredible producers. Like when I started music, I didn't know a single woman who produced their own music. I mean, I knew Grimes did it, but like even then everyone was like, does she really write her own music? And now it's like, of course, like so many women do these things and they do them so well. And I've had amazing experiences. Like my favorite two audio, like my two favorite sound techs that we ever tour with are both women, and they're like honestly better than any of the men I've ever toured with. But I think it's cool because now when other women come to those shows and they see those women killing it doing those jobs, it gives you like a belief that you could see yourself in that role too. And I think that's cool, and I think it's important. And I think even just like, I remember being really nervous when I was younger to speak up about the things that I thought were unfair. And then since I now have a lot less problem doing that. But I think it's important to see other people do it. Because when you see other people be like, this is unjust, or this isn't fair, or this shouldn't be that way, then you feel braver to be like, yeah, I also have experienced that. And I don't think it's right either. And, you know, power in numbers.
I'd like to turn to another song. So this song is called Small Talk. Now, the video for Small Talk is one of my favorites. Can you tell us a bit about the idea and the concept behind it?
Absolutely. So this is like, I mean, I made quite a few music videos over the years, but this is my favorite one for a bunch of reasons. One is that I got to collaborate with Amy and Nora of Quote Unquote Collective, who are like this incredible feminist theater duo. And if you don't know them, you should check them out. They've made this amazing play and movie called Mouthpiece, and another play called Now You See Her, and they're both just like, I don't know, they're the coolest. I love working with them, and they directed this movie or this music video, and we had so much fun like interrogating what it's like to repress your feelings in public and try to be okay when you're not, or try to be, I don't know, I feel like so often I'm like feeling like I need to put on a happy face or like be sunny when I don't feel sunny, or smile when I don't feel like it. And so it was fun to explore through movement what it feels like when you're kind of erupting and you're trying not to. I also used to dance a lot when I was younger, and I really love dance. And so being able to incorporate that into my music in a new way is super exciting. So it was so fun to make. And as you see, if you watch the video, like some of it was super intimidating. Like I had to do my little eruption dance on the GO train, and we were totally shooting guerrilla style. Like we were not supposed to be there, and everyone was looking at me and pointing at me, and I felt so self-conscious. So it took a lot of bravery. And I say that because I feel like Amy and Nora really, like, they're so brave about the way they do their art, and it gave me a lot of inspiration. So it was a lot of fun.
Try!
So what are you working on now? And how has quarantine been for your creative process?
So I would say, I guess, two things. On the one hand, so I applied for this master's program more than a year ago, like a year and a half ago, maybe. And I just knew I was working on a new record and I was having fun on it, but I was also like running into a lot of blocks and I was struggling with the subject matter. I really want to, the focus of my next record and the thing I'm like really interested in right now is alternatives to capitalism and a criticism of capitalism. I think that so often when I'm like interrogating things that are wrong, whether it be through like in patriarchy or in colonization or all these things, like capitalism is this underlying worldview that creates so many of the problems. Like it's the inherent problem with climate change. It's a problem with so many things. And I was really struggling to find the words for that. And I guess, like, I mean, it's hard to write pop music about stuff like this, but I found out about this master's program and I got really excited because they really encouraged artists and all kinds of people to do it. Like it wasn't just for academics or it wasn't just for people who are teachers. And it's a focus on adult education. And I was kind of realizing, like, I guess I've always hoped my music is kind of a tool of adult education in a way, like a way of making people think and question things. So it is a total fluke that, I mean, I got in February 2020 and then the pandemic hit in March. And I'm so grateful because I don't know what I would be doing with my time right now if I didn't have this. Pandemic's been hard. I know it's been really hard for everybody. I miss my bandmates. I hate not being able to see them and collaborate. I'm a really social, I'm like an off the charts extrovert. So not being able to see people is really not that fun for me. And it's hard for the music making too, because I'm like a collaborative person. I like the energy of people together in a room making stuff. I also like had to move out of my house because it's under construction. And so I'm like displaced from my home and there's all these things going on. And it's been a lot. But I feel grateful that I have something else to focus on because so many of my bandmates and my peers are a lot more in a more precarious situation right now than I am. And I really feel for them because it's really hard to know when anything's going to start back up again. And I have friends who've been releasing music this year and it's cool because people are at home and they're sad and they want to listen, but they can't tour and they can't promote it in the ways that they would. And they can't necessarily shoot music videos the way that they would. And they can't go have meetings with people and go network and do all these things that are such a fundamental part of trying to get your music heard. So yeah, I don't know. It's a hard time to be a musician. And I think I'm so conscious of just like, it's a hard time that doesn't have an end. Right now, we just have no idea when that's going to end. And it feels like the last priority, and understandably the last priority. Like I get that, you know, having concerts start again is not anyone's first priority right now, but what I would do to be in a crowd, like listening to live music, I would do anything.
Yeah. I know you're not alone in that. Might not be a priority, but a lot of people are itching for that for sure. So you mentioned you've kind of been working on some new things. Do you want to share about what that is and maybe what people can expect in the future with your music?
Sure. I have to say it's a lot of big question marks right now. Like I've been working on it for a while. And like I said, I kind of felt like I hit a bit of a roadblock. Mm-hmm. And now I've been doing school and I've been honestly so busy with school that I haven't had as much time as I imagined to be writing music. But at the same time, everything I'm learning, I know it's going to go into music. Like I'm having such a transformative worldview kind of experience right now that I am excited about what's going to come of it. So like this semester, for example, I'm taking this feminist theory class and I'm taking an Indigenous worldviews class, which is like totally blowing my mind. And I have the most amazing professor. Her name's Dr. Wemigwans, and she's the most like warm and open, awesome person teaching us about how to approach decolonization in this way that's like not super intimidating. Mm-hmm. And it's really welcoming and beautiful. And it seems to offer so many answers to things that I feel like from a colonial perspective, I'm like, yeah, like how are we ever going to dismantle capitalism? Or like, how are we ever going to actually achieve like feminist equality? And it's like, there's so many amazing ideas that have been here since before settlers came that we, if we just like look back, they're there. So I'm toying with all these ideas and I have so much I want to say and write about, but it's also intimidating subject matter. And I also am super conscious of like, I don't want to center my voice in that conversation. And yet I'm excited to explore what that could look like. Before the pandemic hit, I'd probably written, I want to say 5 or 6 songs that I imagined were going to be on this next record. And now I don't know if they're going to be on it or not, because so much has changed and so much is like in flux, I think. But I still really like those songs, so there's a good chance they will. But I think that whatever, like my semester will wrap up in April, so very soon. And then I'm really hoping to focus my summer heavily on the music and now taking all I've learned and making something out of it. And I'm not totally sure what that's going to be yet. Like maybe part of me is like, maybe I should just do a 180 and like record it all on with the guitar instead of my normal like keyboard and the arpeggiators. But then I love dance music. So I don't know. We'll have to see.
Dance music. Yeah. Dance is important right now. For sure. Actually.
This book, the feminism, Living a Feminist Life book I was mentioning, talks about how one of the things in your feminist toolkit should be, well, it talks about being your body, but how dancing is a feminist pedagogy. And I was like, dancing is a feminist pedagogy. Like, I don't know. I feel like dance is where I can feel so free and feel so myself sometimes.
All right. We'll end the show with one of my favorite songs by Four Esme called Doubt Mouth. Can you tell us a bit about the song before we get into it?
Sure. So Doubt Mouth is about like having the doubt to speak up and feeling like you have to be quiet or be polite or be, you just have to be really careful not to be too much if you want people to take you seriously as a woman, which is completely unfair, but something that I was really struggling with when I was writing this record. And unfortunately, that has not changed at all for me. And I don't know if it has for you or for the other women listening, but I find whatever new space I'm operating in, that same thing comes up. It's like, I just feel women get questioned so much more and get critiqued so much more and underachieve. I watched this amazing video for school the other week about, her name is Paula Williams, and she's a trans woman, and she talks about her experience of living as a man first and then as a woman. And she says that once she transitioned, men started telling her that she was wrong all the time and that she never experienced that before. And it was really interesting to hear it from someone who's like been on both sides. And she's like, yeah, 100%, like women get fed doubt all the time. And I was like, oh my god, like I already knew it was real, but it's like there's another example that it's 100% real. So that's what this song is about, is not feeling like you can't speak up, or feeling like you can't speak up and then doing it anyway.
Perfect. So this is Doubt Mouth by Four Esme.
Keeping quiet.
for those who want to follow your music, support you online, where's the best place to find you?
It's all on Spotify. And of course, but I also am very conscious that Spotify is evil and we all should stop promoting it. So Bandcamp is a great place to buy it or to listen to it. I have so much fun working visually. So I'm really on the, for the songs that I do have videos for, like I love sharing them on YouTube. It's all on, I mean, it's on everything. It's on Apple Music. I think it's probably on Amazon, but I don't know how to find that. I will shout out in the name of the pandemic that Bandcamp is really cool and it's been doing a really fabulous job of supporting artists this year. And I'm pretty grateful for that.
Up next is our interview with Tori from Medical Her Story. Medical Her Story is a web-based platform for women and femme-identified folks to share their experiences and challenges in regards to healthcare, medicine, and wellness.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with you and the project, can you introduce yourself and tell us about how Medical Her Story came to be?
Of course. So, hi everyone. My name is Tori. I'm the founder of Medical Her Story. We're an award-winning international nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness on gender health equity through storytelling and undoing stigma. So the project was born out of my own lived experience of dealing with chronic yeast infections and sort of navigating these two really challenging barriers. One was like this lack of medical care or compassion that my ailments were receiving, just because I wasn't being taken seriously, but rather treated as being overly emotional and just making a big deal out of nothing, which I promise you I wasn't. The other one was just this silence that I was living in. We're sort of told from a young age that discussing our bodies, especially our genitals, is very inappropriate, very unladylike, and that these are the discourses that just prevented me from feeling comfortable sharing what I was going through with others. So obviously a lot has changed in those years, as this has become something I talk about quite frequently. And I think what happened is that sometimes silence can just become deafening. I got so fed up with all these invasive exams, lost test kits, unsafe referrals, and just so much pain that I had to say something. So funnily enough, I published a story in the McGill Daily, and it made the front page. It garnered attention from other people starting to share their experiences of medical mistreatment they'd been through, other undiagnosed distress they'd been going through, and just general shame around their bodies. So at the time, I knew that there really wasn't a space to be gathering all these stories, and I really wanted there to be, which is why I created Medical Her Story. And now we publish other women and femmes' firsthand experiences with health and medicine. We hold educational events, workshops, and we go on some podcasts like this one.
Cool. So you mentioned that the project highlights that medicine is not a domain untouched by larger structures like sexism, racism, classism, ableism. Can you elaborate a bit on what that means for this project?
Yes. So I think a lot of people love to believe that medicine is sort of purely objective, factual, and scientific. But if you're in any way marginalized and have ever found yourself in a situation where you're a patient, then you probably know all too well that medical encounters aren't just influenced by these larger inequalities, but that within like clinical spaces, when you're alone with a doctor, these inequalities can actually become even more concentrated on individual bodies. Mm-hmm. And this can result in a whole range of consequences from having a lack of access, lost hope, or even lost lives. Because if you're, let's say, low income, racialized, disabled, or femme presenting, you're going to face a medical system that not only has this interpersonal and implicit bias coming from medical personnel, but institutional barriers and systems of oppression that are actually embedded within the care you're getting. So while at Medical Her Story, we do focus more on gender health inequity, we have to acknowledge that all forms of oppression are really intertwined and intersecting, and you can't really even understand or begin to address one if you don't acknowledge all of them.
You mentioned barriers. What are these barriers that women and femmes face in the medical setting?
Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to have different experiences, but we do know some things from research. We know that many conditions that affect people with vaginas are under-researched, they're underfunded, and they're underserved. We know that although women are twice as likely to suffer from chronic pain than men, their pain is more likely to be dismissed. We know that in studies where men and women present identical symptoms, that women are more likely to be diagnosed with a mental condition instead of a physical one. We know that it can take years for gynecological issues to be diagnosed or treated. Let's see what else. We know that maternal mortality is 4 times higher for Black birthing people. And we all know that reproductive rights are ongoingly under threat around the world. So I think those are just some examples that are really important to sit with and to understand that behind all these examples is problems that when medical practitioners look at women and when women are seeking out care from a medical practitioner, they're up against this double bind of both such a long history of women being seen as hysterical, overly emotional, or dramatic, which means that their pain is more likely to be dismissed. But then there's also fewer treatments and solutions for when women's pain is actually recognized. Mm-hmm. Moreover, other barriers can include stigma and shame surrounding the femme body. So if you're scared to even talk about what's going on with you, it's harder to get care and it's even harder to form communities of care.
Mm-hmm. My next question is a bit similar, so sorry if I'm repeating myself, but so we talked about barriers in the medical setting, but can you tell us more about how gender bias influences our understanding of illness?
Mm-hmm. Maybe since I've given you some facts here, I can draw a bit more on some lived experience, mm-hmm. But also my research. So while I do live with chronic yeast infections, I also have a master's from the University of Cambridge on the subject. So if you do want to learn more, any of our listeners, about my own research, you can check out our YouTube channel. I've published like all our conference talks there and they're pretty accessible, as well as my whole story about suffering with chronic yeast infections is the first one published on Medical Her Story. But chronic yeast infections, if people don't know, 75% of people living with vaginas will get at least one yeast infection in their lifetime, but 5 to 10% will have chronic symptoms that recur on a weekly, monthly, or constant basis and often present for many years. So a yeast infection, if you don't know, means that your genitals can be itching, burning, having weird discharge, and being in a lot of pain. So not very pleasant. And in my own experience, 4 years ago, I first saw a doctor when I had a yeast infection that just wouldn't go away. And this was a really vulnerable setting, right? Like I undressed in front of them, they examined my genitals. I even cried when I was describing the toll that this had taken on my mental health and my daily life. And then I was dismissed with the words, "Some people get colds, some people get chronic yeast infections." And for a long time, I thought, you know, I'm just seeing weird doctors. I thought maybe this is something I just need to deal with alone and get used to. That's what everyone is telling me, and that's really no big deal. I started conducting interviews with other women about their experiences within the US, UK, and Canada, and I was so shocked to hear that we are facing such eerily similar experiences of being dismissed within medical care, being just told no one cares, get in, get out, facing the social stigma around being worried that other people are going to see us as gross, and just facing a lack of resources because the treatments that are out there just don't work, and there's not enough research going on or funding within women's health to solve these issues right now. And I guess something else I talk about in my dissertation is that chronic yeast infections are just one example of a larger issue. And I coined this the paradox of a normal problem within women's health, which just goes like this. So follow me. If society stigmatizes quote unquote normal genitals as pathological, then genital pathologies become normalized. So that's maybe a bit of a complicated academic way of saying that we live in this society where vulvas and vaginas are stereotyped as being dirty, smelly, or shameful, even when they're not infected. So that when you are infected, you face that stigma on top of the fact that no matter how much you're going to clean yourself or have self-surveillance, nothing's going to make it better. And it's really disheartening because you face this double stigma of sort of the same one that most women or people with vaginas face and suffer with, but then added on top of that, you come to embody this fear that we're all aware of around gross, dirty, or infected genitals. So that's something that I touch upon. That's just one example of how women's pain and suffering within medical care can be dismissed, But even sometimes when we normalize it, we're causing pain also when we tell women that, oh, menstrual cramps are normal, everyone has them. Oh, yeast infections are normal, most people have them. In some ways that can help destigmatize issues, but other ways, in a lot of other ways, it can actually contribute to more harm.
Now, Medical Herstory is a website, and as mentioned, people can submit stories and their experiences. Can you tell us more about the impact that this connection offers women and femme?
For sure. So we've created Medical Herstory as both a site for healing and criticism, because when we write about our own experiences, that's a great way to sort of process what we've been through, to come to terms with something we've been struggling with or trying to understand. So one aspect of Medical Herstory can stop there once you put your thoughts onto paper. But the other begins when you share that story. So when you share a story about abortion, vaginal cysts, menstruation, and those stories appear on somebody else's timeline, you're either placing that person within two positions. So as the reader, you're placed in one of two positions, right? Either you read this story and the topic becomes humanized to you or normalized to you. And in that way, you become more sympathetic, more empathetic, more educated. Or you recognize your own experience in this story and you know that you're not alone. Or I guess there's a third option in which you read these stories and think, ooh, gross, but then you're just part of the problem. So in sharing these stories, what I'm trying to say is that we do form this community where it's acceptable and encouraged to discuss our stories of being in these messy, uncomfortable bodies. But it's also a space where we can witness others doing the same and sort of turn to them to be role models.
And what have been some of the submissions that you've received that have made an impact on you?
That's a tough question. And I'm honest when I say that they're all my favorites, but every story we received has really impacted me because I've learned so much about other people's experiences and what they faced. And that's coming from someone who for the past 6 years has been within academic spaces focusing on women's health. So that does say a lot, not only about the education that we lack, but how powerful these stories are, that they're really touching on these issues and touching on them in such a way that's really educating everybody. Because we only really live in one experience, right? But storytelling at Medical Herstory is so raw and vulnerable that it really almost lets you see what it's like through that person's eyes or in their body, in my experience at least. I encourage everyone to read them and see if you have the same experience, but we really try to capture that raw emotion. Mm-hmm. And being able to read these stories and really feel them is what makes me a better advocate for others and reflect on my own experience by looking at it in different ways too. I'm really proud to have covered so many topics. If you go on the website, we have things ranging from ovarian cancer to miscarriage, eating disorders, autoimmune diseases, queer experiences, pelvic exams, so much more. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, we try to expand what's traditionally thought of when addressing women's health and open up all of these nuances and details of our experiences from different perspectives. And if you do want me to give an answer, I'll say that two stories that really touched me are Ouchie and So Tight. Funnily enough, they're both about the topic vaginismus, which is a condition where your vaginal muscles can involuntarily contract with penetration of any kind. And that's obviously very painful. Mm-hmm. So in Ouchie, a young woman loses her virginity and is in so much pain and so confused that she visits her doctor, only to be prescribed, not lube, not reassurance, but numbing cream. And in So Tight, however, it details the experience of actually living with vaginismus. So spoiler alert, the first experience was simply a young woman losing her virginity and not using lube. In the second one, we sort of get a glimpse into this complex internal battle that goes on living with vaginismus when sex is painful, but you still really want sex. And essentially, if this makes you a bad feminist. So both of these stories use humor to tell their stories, which I think is great and makes them really accessible to read because they do touch on such a heavy topic. But it just makes it more relatable for those of us who have painful sex for whatever reason and raise awareness on it and sort of normalize those discussions, which I think is a great thing to do for women out there and their partners.
Mm-hmm. What is your hope for medical herstory moving forward?
Sure. So my hope is that we can continue to share even more stories. If you're listening and you have one to share, we would love to help you publish it. And my goal is that we can use our voices and experiences to start enacting real change within both society and at the medical level. I want to keep creating this space for connection, education, and advocacy at the same time. And I'll give a little shameless plug that we are recruiting volunteers now. So if you're interested in our mission and would like to help us spread awareness and community, we'd love to have you.
Awesome. I did want to ask also, you mentioned at the top of the interview that you also do events or participate in events. Can you tell us a bit about that and some events that you've done?
For sure. So we held a feminist health research conference where we got to hear from students studying anthropology, sociology, philosophy, and history, all addressing health and women's health from a feminist lens. So it was really interesting to see how you could apply sort of this outlook onto different topics. We looked at migrant health. We looked at painful breastfeeding, gestational diabetes, postpartum depression. So that was a great event we did. We also hold some less academic events, such as sex positive pub quizzes, where you get to learn a lot about different issues. And then what else have we done? Oh, and then we also love to collaborate. So we're going to collaborate with the Thrive Club on an upcoming film screening about women living with chronic illness within Montreal, which we are very excited about.
Oh, wow. Cool. Now, if people want to learn more or join or volunteer, where can they go?
For sure. So you can check out medicalherstory.com to read all our stories or share your own. And you can find us on social media at medicalherstory. So on Facebook, Instagram, we even have a YouTube channel. So definitely check us out.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
We've come to the end of today's edition of Dragonroot Radio. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be back 2 Mondays from now for more reports on gender-based issues.
You're a silent forest. You're a wild flower. You've been moving backwards into the wildfire. But you're a sharpened arrow, spearing hearts, stone cold. And you're a red winged blackbird, perched up on the window. Darkest of wars. He never gave you time or the space to soar. But you're a sharpened arrow that tried to spear a heart stone cold. And you're a red-winged blackbird perched up on the window.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec. With the It Pays to be Vaccinated contest, your COVID-19 vaccination could pay off big time. Every Friday in August, you could win $150,000 and two scholarships of $10,000. Plus, if you've had both shots September 3rd, there's a draw for 16 scholarships of $20,000 and a jackpot of $1 million. Register now for the It Pays to be Vaccinated contest at quebec.ca/vaccination contest. The sooner you're vaccinated, the faster you can take part. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.